with the question, what is the standard? It's not going to be heavily theological because I'm going to try and give you the answer. For me, the standard is Christ. It's not the Ten Commandments. It's the spirit and heart behind the Ten Commandments and the character of Jesus Christ. That's the standard. But the real question is, what does that have to do with me? And how is the standard supposed to look in me, who's constantly falling short? And the older I get, the less I actually believe in sanctification, because I look at my own inner heart more. And I'm very sympathetic to Paul. The older he became, the longer he walked in the Christian faith. He moves from right down to the worst of sinners, when he should be saying, no, I'm doing really well now. He goes the opposite way. Anyway, that's the broad theme. And I'm looking at the problem of the gap. Tomorrow I'll talk about the gap. The gap between expectation and me. And that gap is sometimes, as I hope, something that you recognize. I hope it's not only in my life. It is. If it is, I'm the one who's in trouble. But I have been too long in ministry and seen too many stories and heard too many stories of the gap between what we're meant to be and our behaviors, because very often we fall so far short. People keep looking up there, and I think, what's up there? You mind the gap. And then on the call of Matthew, we're going to look at one of the stories of the call of Matthew. It's in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 to 13. We'll look at that story and some lessons from that story, and particularly we'll finish it by looking at the gap between the way Jesus treated people and maybe the way sometimes we treat people. Then on Sunday, workshop, I'll probably go more. I'm very flexible. I want discussion about this. I want people to say, well, how do we bridge that gap? Are we meant to bridge the gap? Are we meant to be perfect people, perfect examples of the character of Christ? And there are some challenging texts, both in Scripture and in the writings of Ellen White, which are a big challenge to what God expects of us. And then we'll also look at this book that I talked about, the gold standard. Okay, tonight we're going to look at Daniel, particularly Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 to 2. So I'd like you to have your Bibles open there. And something happens in those two verses, which Keith and Nicholas. But Keith and Nicholas. No? It's not Nicholas?
It is Nicholas.
It's Nicholas. Nicky. Okay, illustrate it for us. All right. Let me read the passage. Daniel 1, verses 1 to 2. Oh, and just before I read it, I picture that Daniel did not write his book as it happened. So when he. When Nebuchadnezzar came in 605 and attacked Jerusalem, Daniel did not think, oh, I must write a book about this. And we'll start with, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. That's a good way to start and start it. I picture that Daniel is writing much later, towards possibly the end of his life, and it's a kind of, or maybe he wrote it in stages, but it's certainly looking back and reflecting on what happened. And when he writes and reflects on what happened, he's giving us big clues into the direction that his book is going and why things happened. And then out of all of that, there was a book I read recently called Against the Flow, written by, he's a mathematician at Oxford University. I've forgotten his name. But he wrote a book on the book of Daniel, interesting, called Against the Flow. And his theology or his understanding of the prophecies of Daniel are very close to what Adventists stand for, except for his emphasis on Antiochus Epiphanes. But the main thrust of the book is asking the question, how did Daniel live such an exemplary life in Babylon? Because today, with people who talk away, we must get away from Babylon. I think the latest messenger has Daniel. In fact, I had a chat with Daniel when he preached it on one occasion, and he said, Lou, you know, we cannot escape from Babylon. We live in Babylon. So even the people who move out to the western edges of Wales or northern western Scotland and or wherever, or Cornwall, and think, you know, we're away from Babylon, we've escaped. Or who lock their houses up against all influences. You cannot escape. There is no escape. And I personally think that that parents, I think there's a place for completely shielding our children when they're little, but we have to recognize there will come a day when they leave home, and that day is when they walk into Babylon. Whether it's work or a student university, they are going to step into the middle of Babylon. And if they are not prepared for that, I would like to suggest that be prepared to lose your children. They must learn to cope with Babylon. Daniel was ready for Babylon. And Daniel goes through the culture of Babylon. He goes through their manipulation. Steve, do you remember the name of the mathematician at Oxford University? Anyway, he talks, yes, you could Google it, Against the Flow, it's called. Okay. He talks about how Daniel must have, and the mindset that Daniel must have prepared enabled for him to go through Babylon, and go through its university, and he clearly went through the universities of Babylon and comes out the other side, just a shining example. Maybe you can take that down, Steve. You're trying to. All right. Good. Okay. Where was I? Okay. Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 to 2.
John Lennox.
Sorry?
John Lennox.
John Lennox. That's him. John Lennox. I'm not recommending you buy the book, unless you're prepared to wrestle with theology about Antiochus Epiphanes and get your brain a bit addled on interpretation of Daniel 11 and stuff like that. Anyway, but the devotional sides of it, I think, are very, very good. Okay, Daniel 1, verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Any secular person who would look at this passage and would say to you, this is a ridiculous statement. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the mightiest empire on the planet at that time, the first, you might say, world empire, against a little city-state, you know, Israel has gone, the northern part of the coalition of God's people has gone. There's just little place called Judah, and this is a king, Jehoiakim, and the fight is on. Massive, Keith, little Nikki, and the question is, who would win the battle? If there was a real fight between Keith and Nikki, Keith would pick him up and carry him off, you know. Game over. When I was thinking about this, the two opponents here, I thought of, what if America went to war with Iceland? Do you know what Iceland's military might is? They have two small naval vessels and three airplanes and no army. Okay, that's it. That's it. Two naval vessels, and I think it's mainly to keep fishing things. Three aeroplanes, and I don't even know what they are, what kind of aeroplanes, and no army. So if they were to go to war, you know, right now, everybody would fall about laughing. Because America is going to wipe them out. Just send one of their ships, would wipe them out. They don't have to send ships, they just send some drones over, and Iceland would be finished. But the text here says, God gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. That's nonsense. History would write, America took Iceland, full stop. Nebuchadnezzar also takes some of the vessels. And think about this. Why would Daniel remember that thing? He also took some vessels, which the Lord gave him. And he puts them in the treasury of his God. I would suggest that Nebuchadnezzar didn't understand really what he was doing. I would guess that Nebuchadnezzar, every time he defeated some king or country, he just said, look, let's take some things from their god. We'll take it back to our museum of relics back in Babylon, and we'll place them there for people to walk past and say, oh yeah, that was the king of so-and-so. Yeah, we wiped him out. That was the king of so-and-so. We wiped them out. These ones are from Jerusalem. There was this guy called Jehovah something. Yeah, we wiped them out. And these are the relics we picked up. But the history of Babylon bookend by the taking of the vessels, and they appear again at the end of the history of Babylon. I want you to jump with me now to Daniel chapter 5. From Daniel chapter 1 has the start of Babylon's battle against the taking of Jerusalem and encountering God, as it were, conquering God and taking the vessels from his temple and sticking them in their temple. And now what happens in chapter 5? Those vessels appear again. Verse 18 to 23. This is Daniel speaking. This is the night of Belshazzar's feast. O king, the Most High God gave, there's that word, gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. Again, that's to the secular mind, that doesn't make sense. That God couldn't even protect his temple, and he's giving the stuff to Nebuchadnezzar? And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would he killed, and whom he would he kept alive, whom he would he raised up, and whom he would he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules. That's an amazing statement. God was ruling when Nebuchadnezzar went and took Jerusalem. And Daniel is now saying to Belshazzar, Belshazzar, your father or your grandfather had to learn something. He had to learn that God actually gave it to him, and that he learned that in his period of madness, he learned that God rules on high. Until he knew the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, and I would read in the word, but you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. That is an amazing speech. Amazing thing to say to the guy who's at that time the king of the world, who is so confident that nothing is going to happen, even though he knows there's an army outside against him. He has a party that night with 1,000 of his lords. No problem. Nothing can happen. And God sends Daniel in and says, Belshazzar, you knew all this. Your father learned it. That God decides who wins. God gives the king to whom he wants, not you, not your father. You knew that, and yet in spite of that, you go and take the vessels and dishonor them. I think there's a difference between Nebuchadnezzar's actions and and Belshazzar's. Nebuchadnezzar is disdain, I think is the word I would use. He disdains God. Who's your God? I took the temple. Look, I took your city. I destroyed it. And I, here's the proof. Here's the vessels in the temple of my God. But he puts them away. He doesn't take them home and say, we will do what we want with them. He doesn't desecrate them, as it were. There's maybe some measure of respect there. But Belshazzar is acting with contempt. His statement to God is, even the God of heaven, which Nebuchadnezzar claimed he bowed to, I don't bow to. I'll show you. Bring those vessels here. This is an act of incredible arrogance. And that very night, his kingdom is taken from him. Our society today teaches that there is no God. He's certainly not in control. And this mindset is what our young people go into. At best, he's irrelevant or not interested. And I can imagine I can imagine people in the universities that our young people will go to, or your children going to school, and they receive something like, your parents go to church? Silly things to do. What a waste of time. They're worshiping nothing. They're worshiping an impotent God who can't do anything. We do not live in a neutral world. And I believe that there must be a counteroffensive on the part of the church and on the part of families to get back this understanding that he rules. It seems to me two things have got to happen. Until he knew that the Most High God rules, Nebuchadnezzar went through that school. It was a tough school for him, but he went through it to learn that the Most High God rules. Daniel already knew it. And that's one of the things we've got to teach our people. And you've got to live it. Are you sure the Most High God rules in your life? And I think there's too many Adventists who have a God who's given us a set of doctrines, and we've got 28 now, and that's the list. Or maybe has given you the Ten Commandments in stone, and here it is. That's what you got to do. That's what you got to be obedient to. But we haven't taught them that this is the Most High God rules. I think in recent last couple of years, Cara and I have gone through an experience of asking ourselves, does God really rule? And living that life against the flow, as John Lennox's book says, living it against the flow, because the flow of our society is God does not rule. He doesn't even exist. I don't know whether I'm becoming soft or what, but Cara and I, we were over in Ireland visiting the pastors there 3 weeks ago, something like that. And we decided, was it a game or just checking it out? I said to Cara, you know, if God really does rule, we should be able to see him around us. If he really is involved in our lives daily, we should be able to see the little things that he does. And the trouble is with God, is God is very humble, and he doesn't write his signatures on sunsets. So we see a beautiful sunset, we don't see his signature there. He's humble. Tonight at Bob's place, I shared a little story. I read Toscanini, the conductor. Toscanini, in his first trip to America, was taken and shown the Grand Canyon. He was up in some place and looking at the Grand Canyon, and they sort of expected him to go, wow, that's tremendous. Toscanini became completely silent for a long period of time. And they just watched him, and then he burst into applause, started to clap. And it was for him, that was the natural response to what he saw. He had to applaud what he could see. Now, I wonder if we lose that. We see things and take them for granted. And I think it's very easy up in Crieff to see the beauty around it and just, yeah, you don't take it for granted. You do talk of the beauty, but I wonder if you see the signature there, which isn't there because he's humble about it. He doesn't show off. Anyway, Cara and I decided, let's just ask God. And each day we looked for something, believing that in him we live and move and have our being. If that's true, if it's true, do you believe it? Kind of a challenge I'm giving you. Can you point to it? So each day we looked for God's hand in little things. And we were shocked at how each day, at the end of the day, we said, we saw it. We saw it in this event, this little event, that little event. Let me give you a few. We went to a hotel in Belfast. And it was in the middle of Belfast, and I didn't know it didn't have a car park. So we pulled up outside, and I went in. And I said to the guy, where do we park? He says, we don't have a car park. We don't have a car park. He said, there is a car park down a couple of streets. You go in there, and just a normal NCP car park. I said, oh, really? He said, yep. He said, well, there is a street that cuts behind the hotel and up onto another main street, and there's a few parking places at the end, but you won't get one there. He said, just, they're always taken. So I said to the car, let's try it. So we drove up there, and you wouldn't believe it. As we drove up to it, a car just pulled out in front of us. It was like, I mean, okay, last you've come. The car pulled out, we just pulled in and parked. Now, somebody might say, oh, come on, Lou, that was just coincidence. Or it could be, there's a God who rules, even the little things. But we don't see it. What's another one? One I like is that we went to this hotel in the middle of Southern Ireland somewhere. It's just a little village, a little town. And it's a laid-back Irish hotel. It wasn't anything special. But we went in there, and there was no one at the counter. So we sat there and looked around and waited, and then I looked through, and there was a bar area, and there was a guy in there serving people, and I saw that he saw me waiting there, so I thought, well, he knows. If he sees us waiting long enough, something will happen. Eventually, he came out and says, nobody's serving you, and I said, no. He said, I'll book you in, so he came and booked us in, and then off he went. So we went to our rooms, and then we went somewhere to eat. So we decided to go out and find something. So we went to a Chinese restaurant, and walked into the restaurant, and there was a counter there. And while we're waiting for somebody to come and serve us, I grabbed the menu, and we started looking at the menu and talking about the menu, what we could eat. And the lady came, and I said, oh, I just wanted to know, is this vegan? And so we talked about it. She says, well, there's egg in there, but we could take it out, and da-da-da, and I said, well, that would be nice, and that would be nice. She says, okay, well, do you want to pay now? And I said, yeah, why not? Which I thought was strange, because usually you pay at the end of the meal. Anyway, I got the card out and paid for it, and then she left. And kind of standing there, well, this is Ireland, maybe it's... eventually she came back, and I said, do we just go and sit ourselves down anywhere? She said, oh, I thought you wanted a takeaway. I said, no, we came to sit. Oh, she said, well, then I have to have your card back, because I've got to refund you and charge you for eating in. And I said, will it cost much more? She said, it'll double. I said, we'll do the takeaway. Because it was only about £10. So she said, okay. So we took the takeaway. On the way back to the hotel, we realized we had no cutlery, no plates, just three tubs of rice and two dishes. And Karen and I were told, what are we going to do? I said, well, we can just be back in Egypt. In Egypt, so they're quite good at eating with hands. So as we walked back into the hotel, just as we walked to the main door again, there was no one at the counter, and we were about to go up to the stairs when the guy in the pub came out for some other reason. He saw us. Oh, he said, you've got a takeaway. He said, yeah, yeah. He said, do you need cutlery? Do you need plates? Well, it'd be nice, we said. He said, tell you what, do you like rugby? And the World Cup game was on, and I said, yes, please. Karen didn't say that. He said, come in the pub, come in the pub, come on, come on. And he said, I'll set you up. So he took us, set a table up for us, plates and cutlery and everything, and the big TV screen there. So we watched the game and ate. And he came and cleared up and served us so nicely. I said, do we owe you anything? No, not at all. He said, you're in our hotel, you're very welcome. And we went out and said, well, there he was again. That coincidence? Or was God just that little touch of a God who steps in and says, I'm involved in your life and I look after you, little things, you know? And we don't take, we just ignore them because he doesn't put his signature. Another one, one hotel we stayed at, a vehicle, we were staying there a couple of days, a vehicle, I parked quite close to this large van. And in the morning, I clearly saw that as he turned, he must have just swiped the side of the car very lightly. But there was this scratch about that long. And I thought, because they said to me at the airport, any accident, we take £1,000 off your credit card straight away. And we'll sort it out later. £1,000 off my credit card. And I looked at this and I thought, this is not good, God. And he'd step in. And I looked around and there was a garage over the road. So I drove the car over there and the guy came out. And he said, what's the problem? I said, look, I've got this scratch. He said, you haven't got a panel beater here or somebody, body. He said, we have. He could sort that. He said, just a minute. Oh, he came back and said, no, I'm sorry, the guy's gone out. It's going to be about an hour before he comes back. Can you wait? And I said, no, we can't. I've got an appointment. He said, well, come back later. So off we went. I thought, oh, you know, this is going to cost me a lot of money. So we drove up, and the person we're going to see was an hour late coming. So that took us back another hour. And by the time we drove back, it was about 4:30. And I thought, this is not going to work. You know, the guy's going to say, we're about to close shop. Pulled up, and the guy who had seen me earlier came out, and he said, he's just left. I said, what? He says, he's just left. I'm really sorry, but he's gone. But there was another man there, and he said, what you need is some teacup. I said, yeah, but you know, I have nothing. I don't have any cloths or anything. He said, listen, drive down there, and you'll find this shop in an estate. Well, hurry, it's going to close soon. And ask for some teacup there. So we drove down there and got the guy just in time. And I bought this little bottle of teacup and came out and got some toilet paper, wet it a bit, put some teacup on and gently rubbed it. And then I called Karen around and I said, where is it, Karen? She couldn't find it. I said, we did it. We just saved £1,000. Coincidence? Or is there a God who rules everything? And not just the big thing, not just sets up nations and takes them down, but actually rules in your life. The God who is your Father. What Scripture teaches, as clearly as the Sabbath, maybe even clearer. I had hoped to have recommended a book to Doug, but I found that he had already read it when I spoke to him about it. In fact, he told me he recommended it to me. But I read this commentary. I'm reading this commentary on John by Carolyn Lewis. And there's one little part there, I'm going off my notes, in which he talks about Jesus came from God and lived in the bosom of God. Except that the translations don't use the word bosom. They use close to God or near to God or beside God, was beside God. And Caroline Lewis points out that around the late 1700s, there was the development of anatomy and drawings and also the development within Western mind of pornography. And the idea of Jesus suckling at the breast, that picture, the God Jesus who's in the bosom of the Father was too feminine, too problematic, and so they changed the word in the passages in the English. It became near to God or from the heart of God. They don't want to say the words that the Greek meant, the baby suckling at the breast of the mother, that intimacy. And Caroline points out that that word about the closeness of God is right through the Gospel of John and is meant to make us understand that that's the relationship God wants with each of his disciples. That very warm, close relationship. So what do we teach our children? Where did Daniel learn that from? He didn't learn it in Babylon. He must have learned it from his home, somewhere. A mother who said to him, Daniel, and when he's taken away, we think he was a teenager, and there's no record of his mother being there, but his mum and dad must have taught him, and not just taught him, these are the doctrines you hold, or these are the commandments you live by, but must have taught him there is a God behind that, a God who rules and will be with you, Daniel, in all of your life. And against all the obvious circumstances. I love it in Daniel 6, when there's a decree that no one must pray to anyone but the king, that Daniel goes off and prays. You know the story as well as I do. Where does he pray? Opens his windows and prays where? Where? Towards Jerusalem. Do you realize that Jerusalem is in ruins? There is no Jerusalem. Effectively, it is in total ruins. And here's Daniel saying, but it still stands for something. The secular person would say, Daniel, what are you praying to? I'm praying to the God who rules in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem's in ruins, I know. The reality is, there is no God, Daniel. And God says, yes. And Daniel says, yes, there is. I trust him. I'm even prepared to go to the lion's den. And the God who he trusts, in spite of all the circumstances, delivers him. Do your kids, do our children, your grandchildren know that? And my appeal is, we have got to not just teach, this is the Ten Commandments, this is the Sabbath, not that one. We have got to teach them, one, that God rules, but two, revealing the God who's flesh, who's real, who lives with them. And they need to see it in their parents. You know, as ministerial secretary at the union, I get to see a lot more pastors in their homes. And I am deeply saddened by the number of pastors whose children have left the church. Just heartbreaking. I come away from some of those settings and I'm just, God, thank you that you gave me Karen to help our children. And I'm not blaming the pastors because the perfect father lost a third of his children. But I just fear that some of our pastors are not modeling, or some of our parents are not modeling this closeness to God that says to their kid, there is a God. He rules in spite of every circumstance that you see. Like Daniel, I still pray to the God of a ruined Jerusalem because I know he rules. It doesn't look that way at all, but I know he rules. So, what do we do to create that awe of God? Karen, I've read some, I don't know where we read it, Karen. It talked about be still. Be still. Because in our rushed and loud world, the Spirit whispers. There are times when we have to, in the noise and the cacophony of Babylon, we have to teach our children, our young people, and model it. Model it. That we are able to stop and just be still and know that he rules in spite of all the proof against it. And as I said, one of the problems is that God is very humble and he doesn't sign his masterpieces. He gives you the freedom to decide that they just came by chance. So how do we do it? I'm handing it over to you. And I'm not sure what Karen and I did, and I'm not even sure that it was us, but Wow. I was telling Jonathan the other day, one of the finest moments in my life is on a Sabbath when I get up to preach and I know that Daniel is preaching somewhere and my boy Jonathan is preaching at the same time. And because of the time zones are almost the same, I know that when I stand up, these two sons of mine are standing up and preaching as well. You don't know how much a thrill that gives me. I go to the pulpit thinking, my boys are doing this. And I said to Jonathan, one of my prayers is that one day Lani will also be standing up and preaching as she used to. I want to see that. And give me that, God. What a great joy. What do you do? I'm not sure. And so I'm opening it for advice. I'm wanting you to talk to each other about what ideas you have on how to get that message across. There is a God. He rules in spite of everything that Babylon tells us. No, he doesn't. And Lennox makes a very interesting case. Babylon's big deal was on architecture. Is not this great Babylon. And he makes the point that cities today are defined by their architecture. You know, we know Barcelona because of incredible buildings there. We know London with the London Eye and the you know, the great buildings there. We talk about architecture that defines. And he talked about the multiplicity of gods in Babylon. And he said, and yet all of them were actually saying that God doesn't exist, is nobody. And today we have a multiplicity of gods. We don't call them gods. We call them money. We call them wealth. We call them sex. We call them power, jobs, whatever. But they're all the ones that give us our security and say, we don't trust that one, not the guy up there. This is the God we put our trust in. That's what we have to counter against, that loud noise of all the gods saying, I'm God, listen to me. And we have to teach our children so that in that noise, that loud noise, neon signs, our children are able to stop and be still. Say, there's a God. Okay, I'm going to do a pair and share. I'm going to ask you to turn to someone and just have a quick chat with them. I'll give you a minute or two. Just talk to them about what we could do to develop that sense of the realness of God in our daily lives. Can you do that? Maybe with someone other than your spouse. Could you do that? Just turn to someone and just say, what could we do to develop that sense of the reality of God?